bundle, dropped it again, and ran into the entry. Fear gained more and more mastery over him, especially after this second, quite unexpected murder. He longed to run away from the place as fast as possible. And if at that moment he had been capable of seeing and reasoning more correctly, if he had been able to realize all the difficulties of his position, the hopelessness, the hideousness, and the absurdity of it, if he could have understood how many obstacles and perhaps crimes he had still to overcome or to commit to get out of that place and to make his way home, it is very possible that he would have flung up everything and would have gone to give himself up, and not from fear, but from simple horror and loathing of what he had done. The feeling of loathing especially surged up within him and grew stronger every minute. He wouldn't now have gone to the box or even into the room for anything in the world. But a sort of blankness, even dreaminess, had begun by degrees to take possession of him. At moments he forgot himself, or rather forgot what was of importance, and caught at trifles. Glancing, however, into the kitchen and seeing a bucket half full of water on a bench, he bethought him of washing his hands and the axe. His hands were sticky with blood. He dropped the axe with the blade in the water, snatched a piece of soap that lay in a broken saucer on the window, and began washing his hands in the bucket. When they were clean, he took out the axe, washed the blade, and spent a long time, about 3 minutes, washing the wood where there were spots of blood, rubbing them with soap. Then he wiped it all with some linen that was hanging to dry on a line in the kitchen, and then he was a long while attentively examining the axe at the window. There was no trace left on it. Only the wood was still damp. He carefully hung the axe in the noose under his coat. Then, as far as was possible, in the dim light in the kitchen, he looked over his overcoat, his trousers, and his boots. At the first glance there seemed to be nothing but stains on the boots. He wetted the rag and rubbed the boots. But he knew he was not looking thoroughly, that there might be something quite noticeable that he was overlooking. He stood in the middle of the room, lost in thought. Dark, agonizing ideas rose in his mind. The idea that he was mad, and that at that moment he was incapable of reasoning, of protecting himself, that he ought perhaps to be doing something utterly different from what he was now doing. "Good God," he muttered, "I must fly, fly," and he rushed into the entry. But here a shock of terror awaited him such as he had never known before. He stood and gazed, and could not believe his eyes. The door, the outer door from the stairs, at which he had not long before waited and rung, was standing unfastened, and at least 6 inches open. No lock, no bolt, all the time, all that time. The old woman had not shut it after him, perhaps as a precaution. But good God! Why, he had seen Lizaveta afterwards. And how could he have failed to reflect that she must have come in somehow? She could not have come through the wall. He dashed to the door and fastened the latch. But no, the wrong thing again. I must get away. Get away! He unfastened the latch, opened the door, and began listening on the staircase. He listened a long time. Somewhere far away, it might be in the gateway, two voices were loudly and shrilly shouting, quarreling and scolding. What are they about? He waited patiently. At last all was still, as though suddenly cut off. They had separated. He was meaning to go out, but suddenly, on the floor below, a door was noisily opened, and someone began going downstairs humming a tune. "How is it they all make such a noise?" flashed through his mind. Once more he closed the door and waited. At last all was still, not a soul stirring. He was just taking a step towards the stairs when he heard fresh footsteps. The steps sounded very far off, at the very bottom of the stairs. But he remembered quite clearly and distinctly that from the first sound he began for some reason to suspect that this was someone coming there, to the fourth floor, to the old woman. Why? Were the sounds somehow peculiar, significant? The steps were heavy, even and unhurried. Now he had passed the first floor. Now he was mounting higher. It was growing more and more distinct. He could hear his heavy breathing. And now the third story had been reached. Coming here. And it seemed to him all at once that he was turned to stone. That it was like a dream in which one is being pursued, nearly caught, and will be killed, and is rooted to the spot, and cannot even move one's arms. At last, when the unknown was mounting to the fourth floor, he suddenly started and succeeded in slipping neatly and quickly back into the flat and closing the door behind him. Then he took the hook and softly, noiselessly, fixed it in the catch. Instinct helped him. When he had done this, he crouched, holding his breath by the door. The unknown visitor was by now also at the door. They were now standing opposite one another, as he had just before been standing with the old woman, when the door divided them and he was listening. The visitor panted several times. "He must be a big, fat man," thought Raskolnikov, squeezing the axe in his hand. It seemed like a dream indeed. The visitor took hold of the bell and rang loudly. As soon as the tin bell tinkled, Raskolnikov seemed to be aware of something moving in the room. For some seconds he listened quite seriously. The unknown rang again, waited, and suddenly tugged violently and impatiently at the handle of the door. Raskolnikov gazed in horror at the hook shaking in its fastening, and in blank terror expected every minute that the fastening would be pulled out. It certainly did seem possible, so violently was he shaking it. He was tempted to hold the fastening, but he might be aware of it. A giddiness came over him again. "I shall fall down," flashed through his mind, but the unknown began to speak, and he recovered himself at once.
"What's up? Are they asleep or murdered? Damn them," he bawled in a thick voice. "Hey, Alyona Ivanovna, old witch! Lizaveta Ivanovna, hey, my beauty, open the door! Ah, damn them, are they asleep or what?" And again enraged, he tugged with all his might a dozen times at the bell. He must certainly be a man of authority and an intimate acquaintance. At this moment light, hurried steps were heard not far off on the stairs. Someone else was approaching. Raskolnikov had not heard them at first.
"You don't say there's no one at home?"
the newcomer cried in a cheerful, ringing voice, addressing the first visitor, who still went on pulling the bell.
"Good evening, Koch."
From his voice he must be quite young, thought Raskolnikov.
"Who the devil can tell? I've almost broken the lock,"
answered Koch.
"But how do you come to know me?"
"Why, the day before yesterday I beat you 3 times running at billiards at Gambrinus's."
"Oh.
So, they're not at home? That's queer. It's awfully stupid, though. Where could the old woman have gone? I've come on business."
"Yes, and I have business with her, too."
"Well, what can we do? Go back, I suppose." "Hey, and I was hoping to get some money," cried the young man.
We must give it up, of course. But what did she fix this time for? The old witch fixed the time for me to come herself. It's out of my way. And where the devil she can have got to, I can't make out. She sits here from year's end to year's end, the old hag. Her legs are bad, and yet here all of a sudden she's out for a walk.
Hadn't we better ask the porter?
Why?
Where she's gone, and when she'll be back.
Damn it all, we might ask. But you know she never does go anywhere.
And he once more tugged at the door handle.
Damn it all, there's nothing to be done, we must go.
Stay, cried the young man suddenly. Do you see how the door shakes if you pull it?
Well?
That shows it's not locked, but fastened with the hook. Do you hear how the hook clanks?
Well?
Why, don't you see? That proves that one of them is at home. If they were all out, they would have locked the door from the outside with the key, and not with the hook from inside. There. Do you hear how the hook is clanking? To fasten the hook on the inside, they must be at home, don't you see? So there they are, sitting inside, and don't open the door.
Well, and so they must be, cried Koch, astonished. What are they about in there?
And he began furiously shaking the door.
Stay, cried the young man again. Don't pull at it. There must be something wrong. Here, you've been ringing and pulling at the door, and still they don't open. So either they've both fainted or—
What?
I tell you what. Let's go fetch the porter. Let him wake them up.
All right.
Both were going down.
Stay. You stop here while I run down for the porter.
What for?
Well, you'd better.
All right.
I'm studying the law, you see. It's evident, evident, there's something wrong here.
The young man cried hotly, and he ran downstairs.
Koch remained.
Once more he softly touched the bell, which gave one tinkle, then, gently, as though reflecting and looking about him, began touching the door handle, pulling it and letting it go to make sure once more that it was only fastened by the hook. Then, puffing and panting, he bent down and began looking at the keyhole. But the key was in the lock, on the inside, and so nothing could be seen. Raskolnikov stood, keeping tight hold of the axe. He was in a sort of delirium. He was even making ready to fight when they should come in. While they were knocking and talking together, the idea several times occurred to him to end it all at once and shout to them through the door. Now and then he was tempted to swear at them, to jeer at them, while they could not open the door. "Only make haste," was the thought that flashed through his mind.
"But what the devil is he up to?"
Time was passing. One minute and another. No one came.
Koch began to be restless.
"What the devil?"
he cried suddenly, and, in impatience deserting his sentry duty, he too went down, hurrying and thumping his heavy boots on the stairs. The steps died away.
"Good heavens! What am I to do?"
Raskolnikov unfastened the hook, opened the door. There was no sound. Abruptly, without any thought at all, he went out, closing the door as thoroughly as he could, and went downstairs. He had gone down three flights when he suddenly heard a loud voice below. Where could he go? There was nowhere to hide. He was just going back to the flat.
"Hey there! Catch the beast!"
Somebody dashed out of a flat below, shouting, and rather fell than ran down the stairs, bawling at the top of his voice,
"Mitka! Mitka! 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 Blast him!"
The shout ended in a shriek. The last sounds came from the yard. All was still. But at the same instant, several men talking loud and fast began noisily mounting the stairs. There were three or four of them. He distinguished the ringing voice of the young man.
"They."
Filled with despair, he went straight to meet them, feeling come what must. If they stopped him, all was lost. If they let him pass, all was lost, too. They would remember him. They were approaching. They were only a flight from him, and suddenly, deliverance. A few steps from him on the right, there was an empty flat with the door wide open. The flat on the second floor where the painters had been at work, and which, as though for his benefit, they had just left. It was they, no doubt, who had just run down, shouting. The floor had only just been painted. In the middle of the room stood a pail and a broken pot with paint and brushes. In one instant, he had whisked in at the open door and hidden behind the wall, and only in the nick of time. They had already reached the landing. Then they turned and went on up to the fourth floor, talking loudly. He waited, went out on tiptoe, and ran down the stairs. No one was on the stairs nor in the gateway. He passed quickly through the gateway and turned to the left in the street. He knew perfectly well that at that moment they were at the flat, that they were greatly astonished at finding it unlocked, as the door had just been fastened, that by now they were looking at the bodies, that before another minute had passed, they would guess and completely realize that the murderer had just been there and had succeeded in hiding somewhere, slipping by them and escaping. They would guess most likely that he had been in the empty flat while they were going upstairs. And meanwhile he dared not quicken his pace much, though the next turning was still nearly 100 yards away. Should he slip through some gateway and wait somewhere in an unknown street? No, hopeless. Should he fling away the axe? Should he take a cab? Hopeless, hopeless. At last he reached the turning. He turned down it more dead than alive. Here he was halfway to safety. And he understood it. It was less risky because there was a great crowd of people, and he was lost in it like a grain of sand. But all he had suffered had so weakened him that he could scarcely move. Perspiration ran down him in drops. His neck was all wet.
"My word, he has been at it," someone shouted at him when he came out on the canal bank.
He was only dimly conscious of himself now, and the farther he went, the worse it was. He remembered, however, that on coming out onto the canal bank, he was alarmed at finding few people there, and so being more conspicuous than he had thought of turning back. Though he was almost falling from fatigue, he went a long way round so as to get home from quite a different direction. He wasn't fully conscious when he passed through the gateway of his house. He was already on the staircase before he recollected the axe. And yet he had a very grave problem before him. To put it back and to escape observation as far as possible in doing so. He was, of course, incapable of reflecting that it might perhaps be far better not to restore the axe at all, but to drop it later on in somebody's yard. But it all happened fortunately. The door of the porter's room was closed but not locked, so that it seemed most likely that the porter was at home. But he had so completely lost all power of reflection that he walked straight to the door and opened it. If the porter had asked him, "What do you want?" he would perhaps have simply handed him the axe. But again, the porter was not at home. And he succeeded in putting the axe back under the bench and even covering it with the chunk of wood as before. He met no one, not a soul, afterwards on the way to his room. The landlady's door was shut. When he was in his room, he flung himself on the sofa just as he was. He didn't sleep, but sank into blank forgetfulness. If anyone had come into his room then, he would have jumped up at once and screamed. Scraps and shreds of thoughts were simply swarming in his brain. But he couldn't catch at one. He couldn't rest and won, in spite of all his efforts. Part 2 Chapter 1 So, he lay a very long while. Now and then he seemed to wake up, and at such moments he noticed that it was far into the night. But it didn't occur to him to get up. At last, he noticed that it was beginning to get light. He was lying on his back, still dazed from his recent oblivion. Fearful, despairing cries rose shrilly from the street, sounds which he heard every night, indeed, under his window after 2 o'clock. They woke him up now. "Ah, the drunken men are coming out of the taverns," he thought. "It's past 2 o'clock." And at once he leaped up as though someone had pulled him from the sofa. "What, past 2 o'clock?" He sat down on the sofa, and instantly recollected everything. All at once, in one flash, he recollected everything. For the first moment he thought he was going mad. A dreadful chill came over him, but the chill was from the fever that had begun long before in his sleep. Now he was suddenly taken with violent shivering so that his teeth chattered and all his limbs were shaking. He opened the door and began listening. Everything in the house was asleep. With amazement, he gazed at himself and everything in the room around him, wondering how he could have come in the night before without fastening the door, and have flung himself on the sofa without undressing, without even taking his hat off. It had fallen off, and was lying on the floor near his pillow. "If anyone had come in, what would he have thought? That I'm drunk, but..." He rushed to the window. There was light enough, and he began hurriedly looking himself all over from head to foot. All his clothes. Were there no traces? But there was no doing it like that. Shivering with cold, he began taking off everything and looking over again. He turned everything over to the last threads and rags, and, mistrusting himself, went through his search 3 times. But there seemed to be nothing, no trace. Except in one place, where some thick drops of congealed blood were clinging to the frayed edge of his trousers. He picked up a big clasp knife and cut off the frayed threads. There seemed to be nothing more. Suddenly, he remembered that the purse and the things he had taken out of the old woman's box were still in his pockets. He hadn't thought till then of taking them out and hiding them. He hadn't even thought of them while he was examining his clothes. What next? Instantly he rushed to take them out and fling them on the table. When he had pulled out everything, and turned the pocket inside out to be sure there was nothing left, he carried the whole heap to the corner. The paper had come off the bottom of the wall, and hung there in tatters. He began stuffing all the things into the hole under the paper. "They're in. All out of sight, and the purse, too," he thought gleefully, getting up and gazing blankly at the hole which bulged out more than ever. Suddenly, he shuddered all over with horror. "My God," he whispered in despair, "what's the matter with me? Is that hidden? Is that the way to hide things?" He had not reckoned on having trinkets to hide. He had only thought of money, and so had not prepared a hiding place. "But now, what am I glad of?" he thought. "Is that hiding things, my reasons deserting me, obviously?" He sat down on the sofa in exhaustion, and was at once shaken by another unbearable fit of shivering. Mechanically he drew from a chair beside him his old student's winter coat, which was still warm, though almost in rags, covered himself up with it, and once more sank into drowsiness and delirium. He lost consciousness. Not more than 5 minutes had passed when he jumped up a second time, and at once pounced in a frenzy on his clothes again. "How could I go to sleep again with nothing done? Yes, I have not taken the loop off the armhole. I forgot it. forgot a thing like that. Such a piece of evidence. He pulled off the noose, hurriedly cut it to pieces, and threw the bits among his linen under the pillow. Pieces of torn linen couldn't rouse suspicion, whatever happened. I think not. I think not, anyway, he repeated, standing in the middle of the room. And with painful concentration, he fell to gazing about him again, at the floor and everywhere, trying to make sure he had not forgotten anything. The conviction that all his faculties, even memory, and the simplest power of reflection were failing him, began to be an insufferable torture. Surely it isn't beginning already. Surely it isn't my punishment coming upon me. It is. The frayed rags he had cut off his trousers were actually lying on the floor in the middle of the room, where anyone coming in would see them. "What is the matter with me?" he cried again, like one distraught. Then a strange idea entered his head. That perhaps all his clothes were covered with blood, that perhaps there were a great many stains, but that he didn't see them, didn't notice them because his perceptions were failing, were going to pieces, his reason was clouded. Suddenly he remembered that there had been blood on the purse, too. Ah, then there must be blood on the pocket, too, for I put the wet purse in my pocket. In a flash he had turned the pocket inside out, and yes, there were traces, stains on the lining of the pocket. So my reason has not quite deserted me, so I still have some sense and memory, since I guessed it of myself, he thought triumphantly, with a deep sigh of relief. It's simply the weakness of fever, a moment's delirium. And he tore the whole lining out of the left pocket of his trousers. At that instant, the sunlight fell on his left boot, on the sock which poked out from the boot. He fancied there were traces. He flung off his boots. Traces, indeed! The tip of the sock was soaked with blood. He must have unwarily stepped into that pool. But what am I to do with this now? Where am I to put the sock and rags and pocket? He gathered them all up in his hands and stood in the middle of the room. In the stove? But they would ransack the stove first of all. Burn them? But what can I burn them with? There are no matches, even. No. Better go out and throw it all away somewhere. Yes, better throw it away, he repeated, sitting down on the sofa again. And at once, this minute, without lingering. But his head sank on the pillow instead. Again, the unbearable icy shivering came over him. Again, he drew his coat over him. And for a long while, for some hours, he was haunted by the impulse to go off somewhere at once, this moment, and fling it all away, so that it may be out of sight and done with, at once, at once. Several times he tried to rise from the sofa, but couldn't. He was thoroughly waked up at last by a violent knocking at his door. "Open, please! Are you dead or alive? He keeps sleeping here," shouted Nastasya, banging with her fist on the door. "For whole days together he's snoring here like a dog. A dog he is, too. Open, I tell you, it's past 10."
"Maybe he's not at home," said a man's voice.
"Ah, that's the porter's voice. What does he want?" He jumped up and sat on the sofa. The beating of his heart was a positive pain. "Then who can have latched the door?" retorted Nastasya.
"He's taken to bolting himself in, as if he were worth stealing. Open, you stupid! Wake up!"
"What do they want? Why the porter? All's discovered. Resist or open. Come what may." He half rose, stooped forward, and unlatched the door. His room was so small that he could undo the latch without leaving the bed. Yes, the porter and Nastasya were standing there. Nastasya stared at him in a strange way. He glanced with a defiant and desperate air at the porter, who, without a word,
held out a gray folded paper sealed with bottle wax.
"A notice from the office,"
he announced as he gave him the paper.
"From what office?"
"A summons to the police office, of course. You know which office."
"To the police? What for?"
"How can I tell? You're sent for, so you go."
The man looked at him attentively, looked round the room, and turned to go away.
"He's downright ill," observed Nastasya, not taking her eyes off him.
The porter turned his head for a moment.
"He's been in a fever since yesterday," she added.
Raskolnikov made no response, and held the paper in his hands without opening it.
"Don't you get up, then," Nastasya went on compassionately, seeing that he was letting his feet down from the sofa. "You're ill, and so don't go. There's no such hurry. What have you got there?"
He looked. In his right hand, he held the shreds he had cut from his trousers, the sock, and the rags of the pocket. So, he had been asleep with them in his hand. Afterwards, reflecting upon it, he remembered that half waking up in his fever, he had grasped all this tightly in his hand, and so fallen asleep again.
"Look at the rags he's collected and sleeps with them, as though he has got hold of a treasure."
And Nastasya went off into her hysterical giggle.
Instantly he thrust them all under his great coat and fixed his eyes intently upon her.
Far as he was from being capable of rational reflection at that moment, he felt that no one would behave like that with a person who was going to be arrested.
"But the police?"
"You'd better have some tea, yes?
I'll bring it. There's some left."
"No, I'm going. I'll go at once," he muttered, getting onto his feet.
"Why, you'll never get downstairs."
"Yes, I'll go."
"As you please."
She followed the porter out. At once he rushed to the light to examine the sock and the rags.
"There are stains, but not very noticeable. All covered with dirt, and rubbed and already discolored. No one who had no suspicion could distinguish anything. Nastasya, from a distance, couldn't have noticed, thank God."
Then, with a tremor, he broke the seal of the notice and began reading. He was a long while reading before he understood. It was an ordinary summons from the district police station to appear that day at 9:30 at the office of the district superintendent.
"But when has such a thing happened? I never have anything to do with the police. And why just today?"
he thought in agonizing bewilderment.
"Good God, only get it over soon!"
He was flinging himself on his knees to pray, but broke into laughter, not at the idea of prayer, but at himself. He began hurriedly dressing.
"If I'm lost, I am lost. I don't care. Shall I put the sock on?" he suddenly wondered. "It will get dustier still, and the traces will be gone."
But no sooner had he put it on than he pulled it off again in loathing and horror. He pulled it off, but reflecting that he had no other socks, he picked it up and put it on again, and again he laughed.
"That's all conventional, that's all relative, merely a way of looking at it,"
he thought in a flash, but only on the top surface of his mind, while he was shuddering all over.
"There, I've got it on. I have finished by getting it on."
But his laughter was quickly followed by despair.
"No, it's too much for me," he thought.
His legs shook.
"From fear," he muttered.
His head swam and ached with fever.
"It's a trick. They want to decoy me there and confound me over everything," he mused as he went out onto the stairs. "The worst of it is I'm almost light-headed. I may blurt out something stupid."
On the stairs, he remembered that he was leaving all the things just as they were in the hole in the wall.
"And very likely it's on purpose, to search when I'm out," he thought, and stopped short.
But he was possessed by such despair, such cynicism of misery, if one may so call it, that with a wave of his hand he went on,
"Only to get it over."
In the street the heat was insufferable again. Not a drop of rain had fallen all those days. Again dust, bricks, and mortar. Again the stench from the shops and pothouses. Again the drunken men, the Finnish peddlers, and half-broken-down cabs. The sun shone straight in his eyes, so that it hurt him to look out of them. And he felt his head going round, as a man in a fever is apt to feel when he comes out into the street on a bright sunny day. When he reached the turning into the street, in an agony of trepidation he looked down it, at the house, and at once averted his eyes. "If they question me, perhaps I'll simply tell," he thought, as he drew near the police station. The police station was about a quarter of a mile off. It had lately been moved to new rooms on the fourth floor of a new house. He had been once for a moment in the old office, but long ago. Turning in at the gateway, he saw on the right a flight of stairs which a peasant was mounting with a book in his hand. "A house porter, no doubt. So, then, the office is here." And he began ascending the stairs on the chance. He didn't want to ask questions of anyone. "I'll go in, fall on my knees, and confess everything," he thought, as he reached the fourth floor. The staircase was steep, narrow, and all sloppy with dirty water. The kitchens of the flats opened on to the stairs and stood open almost the whole day, so there was a fearful smell and heat. The staircase was crowded with porters going up and down with their books under their arms, policemen, and persons of all sorts and both sexes. The door of the office, too, stood wide open. Peasants stood waiting within. There, too, the heat was stifling, and there was a sickening smell of fresh paint and stale oil from the newly decorated rooms. After waiting a little, he decided to move forward into the next room. All the rooms were small and low-pitched. A fearful impatience drew him on and on. No one paid attention to him. In the second room some clerks sat writing, dressed hardly better than he was, and rather a queer-looking set. He went up to one of them.
"What is it?"
He showed the notice he had received.
"You are a student?"
the man asked, glancing at the notice.
"Yes, formerly a student."
The clerk looked at him, but without the slightest interest. He was a particularly unkempt person with a look of a fixed idea in his eye. "There would be no getting anything out of him, because he has no interest in anything," thought Raskolnikov.
"Go in there to the head clerk,"
said the clerk, pointing towards the furthest room. He went into that room, the fourth in order. It was a small room, and packed full of people, rather better dressed than in the outer rooms. Among them were two ladies. One, poorly dressed in mourning, sat at the table opposite the chief clerk, writing something at his dictation. The other, a very stout, buxom woman with a purplish-red, blotchy face, excessively smartly dressed with a brooch on her bosom as big as a saucer, was standing on one side, apparently waiting for something. Raskolnikov thrust his notice upon the head clerk. The latter glanced at it, said,
"Wait a minute,"
and went on attending to the lady in mourning. He breathed more freely.
"It can't be that."
By degrees he began to regain confidence. He kept urging himself to have courage and be calm. "Some foolishness, some trifling carelessness, and I may betray myself.
It's a pity there's no air here," he added. "It's stifling. It makes one's head dizzier than ever. And one's mind, too."
He was conscious of a terrible inner turmoil. He was afraid of losing his self-control. He tried to catch at something and fix his mind on it, something quite irrelevant. But he couldn't succeed in this at all. Yet the head clerk greatly interested him. He kept hoping to see through him and guess something from his face. He was a very young man, about 22, with a dark, mobile face that looked older than his years. He was fashionably dressed and foppish, with his hair parted in the middle, well-combed and pomaded, and wore a number of rings on his well-scrubbed fingers and a gold chain on his waistcoat. He said a couple of words in French to a foreigner who was in the room, and said them fairly correctly.
"Luisa Ivanovna, you can sit down,"
he said casually to the gaily dressed, purple-faced lady, who was still standing as though not venturing to sit down, though there was a chair beside her.
"Ich danke,"
said the latter, and softly, with a rustle of silk, she sank into the chair. Her light blue dress, trimmed with white lace, floated about the table like an air balloon, and filled almost half the room. She smelled of scent, but she was obviously embarrassed at filling half the room and smelling so strongly of scent, and though her smile was impudent as well as cringing, it betrayed evident uneasiness. The lady in mourning had done at last and got up. All at once, with some noise, an officer walked in very jauntily, with a peculiar swing of his shoulders at each step. He tossed his cockaded cap on the table and sat down in an easy chair. The smart lady positively skipped from her seat on seeing him and fell to curtsying in a sort of ecstasy. But the officer took not the smallest notice of her, and she didn't venture to sit down again in his presence. He was the assistant superintendent. He had a reddish mustache that stood out horizontally on each side of his face, and extremely small features, expressive of nothing much except a certain insolence. He looked askance and rather indignantly at Raskolnikov. He was so very badly dressed, and in spite of his humiliating position, his bearing was by no means in keeping with his clothes. Raskolnikov had unwarily fixed a very long and direct look on him, so that he felt positively affronted.
"What do you want?"
he shouted, apparently astonished that such a ragged fellow was not annihilated by the majesty of his glance.
"I was summoned by a notice,"
Raskolnikov faltered.
"For the recovery of money due from the student," the head clerk interfered, hurriedly tearing himself from his papers. "Here."
And he flung Raskolnikov a document and pointed out the place.
"Read that."
"Money? What money?"
thought Raskolnikov. "But then it's certainly not that." And he trembled with joy. He felt sudden, intense, indescribable relief. A load was lifted from his back.
"And pray, what time were you directed to appear, sir?"
shouted the assistant superintendent, seeming for some unknown reason more and more aggrieved.
"You are told to come at 9, and now it's 12.
"The notice was only brought me a quarter of an hour ago," Raskolnikov answered loudly over his shoulder. To his own surprise, he too grew suddenly angry, and found a certain pleasure in it.
"And it's enough that I have come here, ill with fever." "Kindly refrain from shouting."
"I'm not shouting. I'm speaking very quietly. It's you who are shouting at me. I'm a student, and allow no one to shout at me." The assistant superintendent was so furious that for the first minute he could only splutter inarticulately. He leaped up from his seat.
"Be silent. You're in a government office. Don't be impudent, sir."
"You're in a government office, too," cried Raskolnikov, "and you're smoking a cigarette, as well as shouting, so you are showing disrespect to all of us." He felt an indescribable satisfaction at having said this. The head clerk looked at him with a smile. The angry assistant superintendent was obviously disconcerted.
"That's not your business," he shouted at last with unnatural loudness. "Kindly make the declaration demanded of you. Show him, Alexander Grigorievich. There is a complaint against you. You don't pay your debts. You're a fine bird."
But Raskolnikov was not listening now. He had eagerly clutched at the paper, in haste to find an explanation. He read it once and a second time, and still didn't understand.
"What is this?"
he asked the head clerk.
"It is for the recovery of money on an IOU, a writ. You must either pay it with all expenses, costs, and so on, or give a written declaration when you can pay it, and at the same time an undertaking not to leave the capital without payment and not to sell or conceal your property. The creditor is at liberty to sell your property and proceed against you according to the law."
"But I am not in debt to anyone."
"It's not our business. Here an IOU for 115 rubles, legally attested, and due for payment, has been brought us for recovery, given by you to the widow of the assessor Zarnitsyn, 9 months ago, and paid over by the widow Zarnitsyn to one Mr. Tcheberov. We therefore summon you hereupon."
"But she is my landlady."
"And what if she is your landlady?"
The head clerk looked at him with a condescending smile of compassion, and at the same time with a certain triumph, as at a novice under fire for the first time, as though he would say, "Well, how do you feel now?" But what did he care now for an IOU, for a writ of recovery? Was that worth worrying about now? Was it worth attention, even? He stood, he read, he listened, he answered, he even asked questions himself, but all mechanically. The triumphant sense of security, of deliverance from overwhelming danger, that was what filled his whole soul that moment, without thought for the future, without analysis, without suppositions or surmises, without doubts, and without questioning. It was an instant of full, direct, purely instinctive joy. But at that very moment something like a thunderstorm took place in the office. The assistant superintendent, still shaken by Raskolnikov's disrespect, still fuming and obviously anxious to keep up his wounded dignity, pounced on the unfortunate smart lady who had been gazing at him ever since he came in with an exceedingly silly smile.
"You shameful hussy!"
he shouted suddenly at the top of his voice. The lady in mourning had left the office.
"What was going on at your house last night, eh? A disgrace again. You're a scandal to the whole street. Fighting and drinking again. Do you want the House of Correction? Why, I have warned you 10 times over that I would not let you off the 11th. And here you are again. Again, you...
The paper fell out of Raskolnikov's hands, and he looked wildly at the smart lady who was so unceremoniously treated. But he soon saw what it meant, and at once began to find positive amusement in the scandal. He listened with pleasure, so that he longed to laugh and laugh. All his nerves were on edge.
"Ilya Petrovich,"
the head clerk was beginning anxiously, but stopped short, for he knew from experience that the enraged assistant could not be stopped except by force.
As for the smart lady, at first she positively trembled before the storm. But strange to say, the more numerous and violent the terms of abuse became, the more amiable she looked, and the more seductive the smiles she lavished on the terrible assistant. She moved uneasily and curtsied incessantly, waiting impatiently for a chance of putting in her word, and at last she found it.
"There was no sort of noise or fighting in my house, Mr. Captain," she pattered all at once, like peas dropping, speaking Russian confidently, though with a strong German accent. "And no sort of scandal. And His Honor came drunk, and it's the whole truth I am telling, Mr. Captain, and I am not to blame. Mine is an honorable house, Mr. Captain, and honorable behavior, Mr. Captain, and I always, always dislike any scandal myself. But he came quite tipsy, and asked for 3 bottles again, and then he lifted up one leg and began playing the pianoforte with 1 foot. And that is not at all right in an honorable house, and he ganz broke the piano. And it was very bad manners indeed, and I said so. And he took up a bottle and began hitting everyone with it. And then I called the porter, and Carl came, and he took Carl and hit him in the eye. And he hit Henriette in the eye, too, and gave me 5 slaps on the cheek. And it was so ungentlemanly in an honorable house, Mr. Captain, and I screamed, and he opened the window over the canal and stood in the window, squealing like a little pig. It was a disgrace. The idea of squealing like a little pig at the window into the street, fie upon him. And Carl pulled him away from the window by his coat, and it is true, Mr. Captain, he tore sein Rock. And then he shouted that man muss pay him 15 rubles damages. And I did pay him, Mr. Captain, 5 rubles for sein Rock. And he is an ungentlemanly visitor and caused all the scandal. I will show you up, he said, for I can write to all the papers about you.
Then he was an author?
Yes, Mr. Captain. And what an ungentlemanly visitor in an honorable house.
Now then, enough. I have told you already. Ilya Petrovich, the head clerk repeated significantly.
The assistant glanced rapidly at him. The head clerk slightly shook his head.
So I tell you this, most respectable Luisa Ivanovna, and I tell it you for the last time, the assistant went on. If there is a scandal in your honorable house once again, I will put you yourself in the lockup, as it is called in polite society. Do you hear? So a literary man, an author, took 5 rubles for his coattail in an honorable house. A nice set, these authors. And he cast a contemptuous glance at Raskolnikov. There was a scandal the other day in a restaurant, too. An author had eaten his dinner and wouldn't pay. I'll write a satire on you, says he. And there was another of them on a steamer last week. Used the most disgraceful language to the respectable family of a civil councillor, his wife and daughter. And there was one of them turned out of a confectioner's shop the other day. They're like that, authors. Literary men, students, town criers. Phew, you get along, I shall look in upon you myself one day. Then you had better be careful. Do you hear?
With hurried deference, Luisa Ivanovna fell to curtsying in all directions, and so curtsied herself to the door. But at the door, she stumbled backwards against a good-looking officer with a fresh, open face and splendid, thick, fair whiskers. This was the superintendent of the district himself, Nikodim Fomitch. Luisa Ivanovna made haste to curtsy almost to the ground, and with mincing little steps, she fluttered out of the office.
"Again thunder and lightning, a hurricane," said Nikodim Fomitch to Ilya Petrovich in a civil and friendly tone.
"You are aroused again. You are fuming again. I heard it on the stairs." "Well, what then?" Ilya Petrovich drawled with gentlemanly nonchalance. And he walked with some papers to another table, with a jaunty swing of his shoulders at each step. "Here, if you will kindly look. An author, or a student, has been one at least, does not pay his debts, has given an IOU, won't clear out of his room, and complaints are constantly being lodged against him, and here he has been pleased to make a protest against my smoking in his presence. He behaves like a cad himself, and just look at him, please. Here's the gentleman, and very attractive he is."
"Poverty is not a vice, my friend. But we know you go off like powder. You can't bear a slight. I dare say you took offence at something and went too far yourself," continued Nikodim Fomitch, turning affably to Raskolnikov.
"But you were wrong there. He is a capital fellow, I assure you. But explosive, explosive.
He gets hot, fires up, boils over, and no stopping him. And then it's all over. And at the bottom he's a heart of gold. His nickname in the regiment was the Explosive Lieutenant."
"And what a regiment it was, too!" cried Ilya Petrovich, much gratified at this agreeable banter, though still sulky.
Raskolnikov had a sudden desire to say something exceptionally pleasant to them all.
"Excuse me, Captain," he began easily, suddenly addressing Nikodim Fomitch. "Will you enter into my position? I am ready to ask pardon if I have been ill-mannered. I am a poor student, sick and shattered—shattered
was the word he used—by
poverty,
I am not studying because I cannot keep myself now, but I shall get money. I have a mother and sister in the province of X. They will send it to me, and I will pay. My landlady is a good-hearted woman, but she is so exasperated at my having lost my lessons and not paying her for the last 4 months that she does not even send up my dinner, and I don't understand this IOU at all. She is asking me to pay her on this IOU. How am I to pay her? Judge for yourselves.
But that is not our business, you know,
the head clerk was observing.
Yes, yes, I perfectly agree with you. But allow me to explain,
Raskolnikov put in again, still addressing Nikodim Fomitch, but trying his best to address Ilya Petrovitch also, though the latter persistently appeared to be rummaging among his papers and to be contemptuously oblivious of him. Allow me to explain that I have been living with her for nearly 3 years, and at first, for why should I not confess it? At the very beginning, I promised to marry her daughter. It was a verbal promise, freely given. She was a girl. Indeed, I liked her, though I was not in love with her. A youthful affair, in fact. That is, I mean to say that my landlady gave me credit freely in those days, and I led a life of... I was very heedless.
Nobody asks you for these personal details, sir. We've no time to waste,
Ilya Petrovitch interposed roughly, and with a note of triumph. But Raskolnikov stopped him hotly, though he suddenly found it exceedingly difficult to speak.
But excuse me, it is for me to explain how it all happened. In my turn, though I agree with you, it is unnecessary. But a year ago, the girl died of typhus. I remained lodging there as before, and when my landlady moved into her present quarters, she said to me, and in a friendly way, that she had complete trust in me, but still would I not give her an IOU for 115 rubles, all the debt I owed her. She said if only I gave her that, she would trust me again, as much as I liked, and that she would never, never, those were her own words, make use of that IOU till I could pay off myself. And now, when I have lost my lessons and have nothing to eat, she takes action against me. What am I to say to that?
All these affecting details are no business of ours,
Ilya Petrovitch interrupted rudely.
You must give a written undertaking, but as for your love affairs and all these tragic events, we have nothing to do with that.
Come now. You are harsh, muttered Nikodim Fomitch, sitting down at the table and also beginning to write.
He looked a little ashamed.
Write,
said the head clerk to Raskolnikov.
Write what?
The latter asked gruffly.
I will dictate to you.
Raskolnikov fancied that the head clerk treated him more casually and contemptuously after his speech. But strange to say, he suddenly felt completely indifferent to anyone's opinion. And this revulsion took place in a flash, in one instant. If he had cared to think a little, he would have been amazed indeed that he could have talked to them like that a minute before, forcing his feelings upon them. And where had those feelings come from? Now, if the whole room had been filled not with police officers, but with those nearest and dearest to him, he would not have found one human word for them, so empty was his heart. A gloomy sensation of agonizing, everlasting solitude and remoteness took conscious form in his soul. It was not the meanness of his sentimental effusions before Ilya Petrovitch, nor the meanness of the latter's triumph over him, that had caused this sudden revulsion in his heart. Oh, what had he to do now with his own baseness, with all these petty vanities, officers, German women, debts, police offices? If he had been sentenced to be burnt at that moment, he would not have stirred, would hardly have heard the sentence to the end. Something was happening to him, entirely new, sudden and unknown. It was not that he understood, but he felt clearly, with all the intensity of sensation, that he could never more appeal to these people in the police office
with sentimental effusions like his recent outburst, or with anything whatever, and that if they had been his own brothers and sisters and not police officers, it would have been utterly out